This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away. All this week, Tell Me More is marking the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's ferocious sweep through the Gulf Coast. In a few minutes, we'll talk about some of the indelible images picked up by one Louisiana photographer who also happens to be an urban planner in the middle of the reconstruction of an urban disaster. But first, as you know, the hurricane claimed the lives of more than 1,400 people and displaced over a million more. We thought this would be a good time to check in on one of the families we met and have been following since the storm. Mary and Morris Martin are former residents of the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, where they lost almost all of their possessions in the aftermath of the hurricane. The Morris family, including a bevy of grandchildren, has since settled in Jackson, Mississippi, and Mary and Morris join us from their home there. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank y'all for having us.
Mrs. Martin, before the storm, you were living in a 5-bedroom house in New Orleans that your husband's family built. But when we last spoke in 2007, you were living with 14 of your grandchildren in a 3-bedroom house with 1 bathroom in Jackson. What are things there like there now?
Well, everything is still the same. We still have all of the kids.
Wait, and how many are there now altogether?
It's 17. They range from 19 to 2.
And you and your husband?
Yes. We still have to stand in line to use the restroom, take a bath.
Can you believe that this is still what you're living with 5 years later? Did you think it was going to be better by now?
I thought, you know, everything would have changed. I would have been able to add on and get another bathroom so the kids wouldn't have to be pushed, you know. But that haven't happened for us, so we just have to make do with what we have.
Mr. Martin, I just wanted to ask you, when I came to visit you guys before, you said that living in Mississippi just wasn't the same, and it was never going to be the same. And it's a few years after that. I wonder, do you feel differently?
No, it's nothing like at home. It's real different living in Mississippi than in New Orleans. New Orleans is 24 hours a day. Mississippi is a half a day.
I actually just stood in front of your house on Flood Street in the lower Ninth Ward and sent you guys some pictures. Did you have a chance to look at them?
Yeah, I looked at them. It kind of got to me a little bit. I just had to try to find some kind of way to get down there and clean up the yard and stuff so I could start doing some work on there when I get some money.
You'd still like to be back there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. 64 years in that house is a long time.
Mrs. Martin, I want to ask you the same thing I just asked your husband about your neighborhood.
It just devastated me to see all of this here because I had not been back there to see what it looked like or anything, and to see the grass and my brand new door that I had just put up. It just hurted me a little bit.
Why haven't you all been able to move back? You're still on the property, right?
Well, the money that we had got, we had to take and pay bills out here, you know, to do things for these kids that we had. Mm-hmm. And we just haven't had enough to really start doing all the things that we had to do because we didn't have nothing when we moved out here.
Do you think that the government, and by government I mean New Orleans, I mean Louisiana, I mean the federal government, should be doing more to help families like you that want to go back?
Well, I think they need to help. Like my mother's house, the road home, FEMA, they didn't give my daughter anything. We did secessions and all kind of stuff, you know, trying to get assistance to help my child rebuild her home back that was destroyed totally. My uncle, they did give him some, but it wasn't what we think his house was worth. And he lost his wife 12 days after the storm. You know, I think it's taking more of a toll on me now than it did. I think reality is really setting in with me about what we lost.
Mrs. Martin, I hate to upset you by asking you this, but you sound almost sadder today than you did when I spoke to you 3 years ago. Are you at all happy with your situation now?
Right now, I make my happiness with the kids. You know, I'm just glad that we had saved the kids, brought them, because we could have been lost in the storm, too.
I'm sorry.
You know, I never went back after the storm to see anything. You know, what people told me about my house, you know, I just accepted what they told me.
So you hadn't seen it until the pictures?
No.
Hey, Mr. Martin.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to ask you one more question, and I just asked your wife the same thing. She said that she feels almost worse than she did a few years ago because you guys hadn't seen what the house looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, is there anything about Jackson that makes you feel that this is a place that you can live, or are you always just going to miss your whole other house?
Well, most likely it'll be missed for the rest of our lives because we spent all our lives down there. And we just now barely get used to Jackson now because we haven't been here no longer than, since 06. Our neighbors in New Orleans always was visiting. We holler across the street or next door. And the neighbors out here, they barely speak. Maybe they'd rather be to themselves than standing up holding a conversation with you.
Mary and Morris Martin are former residents of the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, where they lost just about everything during Hurricane Katrina. They joined us from the tiny home they share with their grandchildren in Jackson, Mississippi. Thank you both for checking in with us, and we wish you all the best of luck.
Okay, thank you for calling.
To see the pictures we talked about, those are the Martins' house on Flood Street in the Ninth Ward, and that's really the name of the street, go to npr.org and click on the programs page to reach Tell Me More. Like the Martins, many other families are still fighting to get back to their homes in New Orleans, and some feel that the challenge is tougher for those from African-American communities than it is for people from predominantly white neighborhoods. Joining us to explain why is Damon Hewitt. He served as the director of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund's Katrina Gulf Coast Project. Welcome, Damon.
Thank you for having me, Ellison.
So how common is it for people that are trying to move back to New Orleans to encounter the same kind of thing the Martins are running into?
Well, there's a fairly common problem. First, most of the federal funds that were appropriated by Congress for housing recovery were dedicated directly for homeowners, funneled through a state program. With most of the residents of New Orleans prior to Hurricane Katrina being renters, they received no direct assistance to help them relocate. But in particular, with respect to the homeowners themselves, there's discrimination built into the fabric of the program. You see, this Road Home program that the state created, an $11 billion program, which is the largest ever housing recovery program in the U.S., bases its grants upon either the pre-storm market value of one's home or the cost to actually repair the home, whichever is lower. And it turns out that most African-American homeowners had their grants based upon the pre-storm market value, which by definition means they had insufficient funds to rebuild.
How many people are we talking about being affected here?
Well, initially, we estimated that about 20,000 African-American households in Orleans Parish, the city of New Orleans, had or would have their grants based upon the pre-storm market value. So it's a huge swath of the city, a very large number of people who were affected.
I know that your organization has been pressing this in court, but before we talk about where that litigation stands now, the judge said that the court doesn't take this lightly. He called it regrettable that some black people got less money than they would have gotten if they lived in white neighborhoods. But there's no recourse for people that have already received their grants?
Well, last week, a federal judge in Washington, D.C., did hold that the program likely violates the Fair Housing Act by virtue of the lawsuit brought by the Greater New Orleans for Housing Action Center, National for Housing Alliance, and the Legal Defense Fund. Now, that holding applies to all future grants. The judge prohibited the state of Louisiana from using this pre-storm market value criterion for any future grants. We are appealing the portion of his prior ruling that holds that he can't address any of the problems with respect to the prior grants. We believe those individuals deserve justice as well.
But right now, there's nothing that they can do, the people that have already received grants. It's only people that haven't yet gotten the money or haven't finished the application process?
There's nothing they can do themselves, but we are fighting in court on their behalf. And also, we've called upon federal and state officials, in particular HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which can step in and intervene right now to correct this problem. We know that there's a fairly sizable surplus for this Road Home program, millions and millions of dollars, about $150 million at least. That money could be used to address those who suffer this discrimination.
So really briefly, the court case is over except for the appeal that you filed.
Well, it's still ongoing. Not over until it's over. The case is still ongoing, and we hope for a favorable result.
This is also pretty personal for you. You are from New Orleans, and your dad had difficulty getting back into his neighborhood briefly, really briefly. How's he doing?
Well, my parents are doing well. They are part of the lucky few who were able to cobble together the resources by fighting the Road Home program, by fighting their insurance company, and by really depleting some of their own resources to get back home and making sure we took care of other family members as well.
How long did it take him to get back?
Took them just about 2 years to get back into their home after bouncing around from a hotel in Houston to a relative's apartment, a sister's apartment in Atlanta, to another apartment outside of New Orleans, and a third apartment, and then finally back home.
Okay. Damon Hewitt led the Katrina Gulf Coast Project for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. He's currently the director of the group's educational project, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. Damon, thanks for your insight.
Thank you.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. We'll hear from a Louisiana photographer talking about his images from just after Katrina and now the oil spill. That's in a few minutes. But first, the state of Virginia can now impose tougher hospital-like regulations on the state's abortion clinics, a determination that could lead to the closure of up to 18 of Virginia's 21 such clinics statewide. Virginia's Attorney General, Ken Cuccinelli, issued the legal opinion this week. With us to discuss the debate, we have Jeff Shapiro, a political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. He joins us from member station WCVE in Richmond, where he also offers political analysis. Hey, Jess, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what does this legal opinion actually mean for the abortion clinics? What would they have to do?
Well, it would mean that the Board of Health would have the power to enact regulations to control these clinics. However, the Board of Health has not regulated these clinics since the late 80s. And many of the current members of the Board of Health, by the way, Democratic appointees, have indicated that they would have reservations about this.
What kind of changes would the clinics actually have to make? And why are so many saying that they might have to close because of this?
The Attorney General, echoing a view expressed by his predecessor, Bob McDonnell, now the Republican governor, is that these are in effect hospitals and that the standards by which they operate should be hospital-like. The clinics counter that these would be extraordinary and extraordinarily expensive and in effect put them out of business, and that that's what this is all about, to make abortion as difficult as possible to obtain in Virginia.
But if the changes are going to still comply with the Supreme Court Roe versus Wade ruling, why would this affect women's access to getting the procedure?
Well, this is one of the questions that has come up, because now in Virginia, the shift in the abortion debate is from the legal to the regulatory and administrative. And if abortion is no longer available, or at least as readily available as it has been, this would have the effect of making it very difficult for a number of women to voluntarily terminate pregnancies, of which there are about 25,000 abortions in Virginia annually.
Briefly, what does the state assembly have to say about all this? Some have accused him of trying to bypass that body.
Virginia has a divided legislature, a Senate controlled by the Democrats, a House controlled by the Republicans, and it is in the Democratic-controlled House that efforts to impose these hospital-like regulations on abortion clinics have failed. That as a result, has shifted this this debate, as I indicated earlier, to the regulatory front. And the Attorney General, Mr. Cuccinelli, is emphasizing that this option is available and it's one that Virginia should consider. It would be left up largely to the governor, however, to ask the Board of Health to enact these regulations. And since these appointees, these Board of Health appointees, are for the most part, Democrats, and might have some reservations about this, one could anticipate a struggle, if not between the board and the governor's office, between the board trustees in court and the governor's office.
Really briefly, when does this go into effect?
Well, it's not clear when this goes into effect. The ball is in the governor's court. It's not clear whether he is going to actually ask the board to impose these regulations.
All right. Jess Shapiro joined us from member station WCVE in Richmond, Virginia, where he is political analyst. He's also a columnist and political reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Thanks, Jess, for checking in with us on this.
Thank you.
All week, we've been taking a look at the Gulf Coast communities affected by Hurricane Katrina, which came ashore 5 years ago this coming Sunday. In the wake of the storm, many were stunned by the images of destruction and the suffering of families and people in need. Documenting the progress of recovery became an important way for people outside of the region to connect with the disaster. Sean Escoffery has made that his calling. He's a city planner by trade, but he's also a New Orleans-based photographer. Sean, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, working as a city planner, how did you end up in New Orleans?
Well, prior to the storm, I had the privilege of working down in New Orleans as a part of a consulting team with the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I instantly fell in love with the culture, the people, and definitely the food and music. After the storm, you know, after watching the devastation on TV, and that, you know, I felt helpless. And as a city planner, I knew that I could do something there and sort of play my part in helping rebuild.
We were all overwhelmed by the 24/7 coverage and the images, but your prints are pretty visceral. I'm looking at one of your photos right now. It's called Waves. It's a house that looks like the structure is rippling like water.
Yeah, and that's exactly what came to my mind when I saw that. And I instantly had to take my camera up and document it. You know, just a water-soaked house can take the shapes of waves.
I remember another image of yours that I think is called Half. It's a very long house, and the center of it looks like a giant foot came down on it.
That's actually from the destruction of a barge that floated around the Lower Ninth Ward after the levees broke there.
When did you take those pictures? What did it feel like?
It was a ghost town when I was there. That was probably about 8 months after the storm. The Lower Ninth Ward was primarily a ghost town. Every once in a while, you'd see a sign of life, someone in their homes trying to take things out and starting to gut their houses.
And just for people that don't know the city, remind us where the Lower Ninth Ward is.
It is technically towards the east side of the city, the opposite of an industrial canal, a major shipping canal.
And was one of the worst places hit.
It was. There was extreme levee failure. Had about anywhere between 10 to 20 feet of water in most of the Lower Ninth Ward.
Let me move on to some of your other wonderful photographs. I know that one of your favorite subjects are the Mardi Gras Indians. Talk to us a little bit about them and why they fascinate you so.
It is absolutely my favorite subject to photograph.
It's the colors, right?
The colors, the craftsmanship of the suits, the beads. They're dancing, the tambourines, the sounds and songs. It is so unique and so uniquely New Orleans. It's something that the average person has probably never experienced before. You know, I fell in love with it because it was such a unique cultural aspect that paid tribute to sort of ancestral relations from Africa or from Western Africa, and then also paying homage and respect to Native Americans who many have sort of taken in some of runaway slaves during the times of slavery. And it's something that is organic in how it grew and how it continues to grow.
I really enjoyed one of your images called Sky Blue Indian. It's that bright fall blue sky that picks up exactly the blue in the outfit.
When I saw that particular chief walking down Claiborne Avenue and that bright blue, you know, I knew I had to shoot sort of low to make him look larger than life, and then to also capture the brilliant sky in the background. I just thought those colors really, really worked together.
I also need to ask you, you have some pictures of fishermen and oystermen along the Gulf, which are also very striking. The one of the captain, the gentleman that's behind the helm, and the sun is rising, or setting, I'm actually not sure which it is.
It's rising.
It's rising, right through the window behind him. And the men with their hands scarred from the oysters, what was it like working with them?
Well, you know, I spent a day on an oyster boat, and it's a tough day. We were out about 5:30 in the morning. You saw the sun rising in the background. And the captain, Judge Williams, he is everything that you would expect a black fisherman to look like.
Just in terms explain of, what you mean.
Just in terms of, you know, weathered skin, this sort of stoic look about him, this look of intensity that never left his face. Mm-hmm. You know, he was always focused. When he was steering the ship and looking off, it was as if he was looking off to the future, you know, or what the future would hold. Whether it was, you know, that day's catch, he was just a perfect, I guess, specimen of what I pictured a fisherman to look like, from the peppered beard to that expression on his face.
Mm-hmm. I wonder whether you think the suffering that people went through after Katrina is at all similar to what the fishermen and other people, business people, people that live there are going through in the wake of the oil spill. Did you take the fishermen photos before or after that happened?
It was probably the second or third week after the oil spill. So, you know, the suffering was being felt while I was there. And in the conversations I had with everyone on board the ship, it was just, you know, there was a degree of uncertainty. They were uncertain if they'd be able to fish those waters again. And for the captain, there was this sort of notion of a lost generation of fishermen. You know, it was already a dying breed, and a catastrophe like this had the potential to completely wipe out this population from fishing or from oystering.
Sean,
yes.
Let me just ask you one last question. If you can kind of blend the vision of your city planner eyes and your photographer eyes, what do you see in New Orleans over the next 5 years?
Over the next 5 years? A city that is on the mend, but that's going to come back stronger. Every second line, every Indian that, you know, that mass each year, you know, it speaks to the rebirth of the city. We're no longer in the recovery mode. We're now moving forward and building for the future. It's about what this city can become, as opposed to just the devastation of Katrina. Now it's about, we want to bring more people who haven't had the time, haven't had the opportunity to come back. We want to make sure that they can come back and that there are jobs here, that there are new schools for their kids to go to school, that the streets are safer. And, you know, we just want a better New Orleans.
Sean Escoffrey works as a New Orleans-based photographer and a city planner. He joined us from our New York bureau. And if you're curious, you can see some of his photographs on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Tell Me More on the programs page. Sean, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your vision.
Thank you.
From the aftermath of flooding in New Orleans to the horrendous damage done overseas by flooding. As you know, millions continue to struggle in Pakistan just to find shelter and food in the midst of unprecedented flooding there. And there's word now that flooding has compounded a severe food shortage in West Africa. In Niger, which is also known as Niger, massive floods have ravaged homes and roads, left 8 million people hungry, and increased the risk of disease. Caroline Gluck is with us to talk about the situation. She's a press officer for Oxfam International, the anti-poverty organization. She joins us from Niger's capital, Yamey. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you.
If I were walking around Yamey right now, what would I see?
You wouldn't necessarily see the extent of the flood damage because it's been very localized. The capital, though, was very badly affected by the flooding, and that's because the River Niger reached its highest levels in more than 80 years. The river flows through several West African countries that have also experienced their own levels of flooding. But here in the capital, families who lived alongside the river were affected, several thousand. Many of them are now living in school buildings and temporary shelter. Some of them are living with hosts, friends, relatives, and some are homeless. So it is bad in areas, and it's not just Niamey. About six other regions of the country have been affected. Thousands of people are homeless. And as you said, it's aggravated an already very serious problem here, which is a food crisis. Around half of the population, nearly 8 million people, facing severe hunger.
And crops and livestock were destroyed here also, so this just exacerbates that other problem.
That's right. People are already on the edge at the moment. It's the peak of the food crisis because people can't harvest the crops until September, October. They've already been struggling to find anything to eat. And, of course, it's the very young children under five who are the worst affected. And then on top of that, in some spots, you have these very severe floods that have wiped out roads, that have flooded people's crops. So things went from bad to worse. We're calling this a double disaster.
What kind of help are you getting from the Western community? And I'm wondering that because in the wake of the Haiti earthquake, the other flooding in Pakistan, I mean, are people getting donor fatigue? Are they caring about this or sending money at all?
Yes, we are getting funds, but it's been extremely slow. Oxfam itself drew on its own emergency reserves to get programs up and running because we weren't getting the scale of outside help that we needed. The floods here, coupled with the extremely serious food crisis, are making millions suffer here in Niger. And Niger and West Africa in general isn't an area that gets a lot of media attention. It doesn't get those dramatic television images that people see on their TV screens every day. And unfortunately, money, funding has been very slow to come.
Is there anything that people here can do to help? I mean, you said you've been having trouble getting money. Do people need to send clothes or shoes, canned goods? Is there anything at all that people can do?
People here are used to years of suffering. There's extremely high malnutrition rates. The country is one of the poorest in the world. It ranks at the bottom of the UN's human development indices. So people have coping mechanisms. They will sell their livestock, for example, to get money for food. There is food in the market. The problem is people here are so desperately poor that they don't have the means to buy the food that's available. We need to help them be able to stand on their own feet. I think we would say we don't need things like clothing and so on. What we need is to be able to give people cash immediately or vouchers or provide them with work opportunities so that they can then go out and buy the food that is available on the market. But in the longer term, we need to look at other things, investing more in agriculture, investing in irrigation so that they can grow crops, diversifying the crops that are available, giving them the things that they need to do to be self-resilient. And that's all called development work. And unfortunately, again, it's less sexy than emergency aid, but it's really vital if countries like Niger can move forward and if the people are to be able to stand on their own feet.
Caroline Gluck is a press officer for Oxfam International. She was kind enough to join us from Yamey, Niger. Thank you for updating us on an awful situation.
Thank you so much.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. It's time to make our way into the beauty shop. And joining me this week to weigh in on some recent items in the news where we figured, well, we needed a woman's touch, are Mary Kate Carey. She's a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush, now a columnist and blogger at U.S. News and World Report. Robin Givhan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning fashion editor at The Washington Post. Anna Marie Cox, the Washington correspondent for GQ magazine, and Galina Espinoza, editorial director at Latina magazine. Welcome, ladies, to the program.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
So I think we're going to have to start, Mary Kate, way north in the Alaska primary. Some people are shocked that the Sarah Palin-backed candidate there, Joe Miller, is leading incumbent Lisa Murkowski. No idea yet who won yet because there are more votes coming in. Should we be surprised she has so much influence?
I think there's a little more to the story there. I was just in Alaska last week for Ted Stevens' funeral and saw Senator Murkowski give a great eulogy for him. But she is part of the political dynasty up there that Stevens was a part of as well. There's no love lost between Sarah Palin and Lisa Murkowski. Palin beat Frank Murkowski, Lisa's father, for the gubernatorial primary a few years back. But what else is going on that particular ballot, which may or may not have gotten told yet, is there was a parental notification measure on the ballot for teens who want to get abortions. And that actually brought out 131,000 votes.
Wow.
And only 90,000 people voted in the Senate race. So far more people turned out for the ballot measure than they did for the Senate race. And Joe Miller, the guy who is leading right now, was opposed – I mean, excuse me, supported the parental notification.
Mm-hmm.
Murkowski did also, but Murkowski's known as a pro-choice Republican. And I think that motivated – his people to come out and tip the scales towards him in what would have otherwise been a low turnout primary. Now, is that Sarah Palin at work? I'm not so sure. I think there were other factors in play. Same thing in the Arizona race. Sarah Palin campaigned for John McCain, but is she considered the tipping factor in that race? Probably not.
So in other words, you're not sure this is going to be a tipping factor across the country?
Yeah, some of it's kind of coincidental,
I think. I think that's right. Also, a main factor in the McCain race is money. I mean, that's actually the story of the night.
This is Anna Marie, by the way.
Yes, sorry. It's Anna Marie Cox. And the main story of the night, to me, less than incumbent versus, you know, resurgence or establishment versus Tea Party was money versus money.
Right.
McCain spent $21 million. He outspent his opponent, J.D. Hayworth, 8-1.
People were thinking Hayworth was going to give him quite the run at first.
That's true. I actually never thought that was going to be the case.
Really? Why not?
Well, there was a solid like 20% of Arizonans always going to vote against McCain, and they're all Republicans. And those are the people that got polled, and that's what made it look closer. But I think that, you know, he still has the appeal that he has, and also he just hammered J.D. Hayworth. And J.D. Hayworth is a terrible candidate. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's just face it. He's kind of stupid.
Why do you say that?
He's kind of dumb.
Well, the infomercial
he's entertaining.
Didn't help.
He's very entertaining.
Yeah,
but he's kind of dumb. He has a long history of like all these kinds of gaffes that he could pull. That they could pull from. He did an infomercial where he talked about getting free government money. That doesn't go over well with Republican primary voters.
No, the host did not call the candidate dumb. Go ahead.
It was someone else that called the candidate dumb. But I think I was going to say that I think in Alaska, I think your analysis makes a lot of sense, especially because the kind of people who would be receptive to a call, to support a parental notification law are Sarah Palin, kind of people. She is, let's not forget, she is actually deeply unpopular in Alaska as a whole and deeply unpopular in the country. Most people would not trust her to run for office.
Right.
I think we need to be very careful in overestimating her power. This is, unfortunately, I think there's a much less sexy sort of storyline here, and it's one that doesn't apply to tonight, but sort of is just we're just going to see it play out in the midterms overall, which is things are going to be generally bad for Democrats and generally less bad for Republicans.
Right.
Robin looks skeptical.
Well, no, I mean, I was just sitting here sort of thinking that, you know, there's been so much emphasis on who Sarah Palin has endorsed, what Sarah Palin has last tweeted or posted on her Facebook. And I've still yet to sort of see that sort of definitive or at least sort of starter sort of survey that really talks to people and says, you know, does she actually make a difference in the way that people think?
Although people aren't turning down her endorsements, let's be real.
Right.
She can bring in money.
Or is it just purely a matter of she is a spotlight magnet, and wherever there's spotlight, money also flows. And so it's less about people actually listening to her thoughtfully, because frankly, she hasn't really said anything thoughtful. And I say that because most of her remarks have come in the form of 140 character tweets, and it's on Facebook. And it's difficult.
Mm.
Yes, and a Facebook paragraph. So I don't know if it's more just she brings attention and thus she brings money, or it's actually that people think, wow, she's really smart. She really represents how I feel. I need to listen to her.
Galena, what are you hearing from your readers? We don't want to leave you out because you're not sitting in the room here.
Well, I think that there is definitely a lot of anti-incumbency fervor going on. I mean, Hispanics, and this has been reported in the last few weeks, are increasingly turning against Obama. And is that having implications for the party overall? Absolutely. I think that most Hispanics feel incredibly let down by the administration. Let's not forget that nearly 70% of Hispanics supported Obama in his in the election. And I think that they did so in large part because of his promises on immigration reform. The fact that, you know, it's more than a year later and this issue, there's been a real failure of leadership in the eyes of many Hispanic constituents, I think you're going to see the consequences of that playing out in the midterm elections.
Before we move on to Florida, Ana Maria, I just want to ask, so do you think that this means the influence of the Tea Party has been overestimated by pundits basically everywhere?
Well, yes, I think actually it has something to do with what Robin was saying. I think that the Tea Party is a really fun story to cover. Sarah Palin is a really fun story to cover. The fact that she brings money and therefore a spotlight is exactly right. And the problem is we need to be careful in how you said there's been a lot of attention paid to Sarah Palin, I think. Mm-hmm. That's one of the evil of passive voice. We in the media pay a lot of attention to Sarah Palin. We need to put an active, you know,
we're talking about her right now.
I actually, for a while, tried to be when I was going to go on chat shows on television. I tried to say I was going to boycott talking about Sarah Palin until it actually looked like she could win something. But that meant I didn't get booked to go on TV very much. And it's very important to my employers that I occasionally do that. So I had to give in and talk about her. But I just have to do a pro forma. Like she polls very badly. No one trusts her to run government. We should all just say that every time we mention her.
Okay. So we're going to move on to Florida. Again, host not saying that. Robin, Kendrick Meek is now the first Black Senate nominee in Florida after defeating Jeff Green. And so we have African-American Democrat running against a Hispanic Republican, Marco Rubio, another Tea Party, and Governor Charlie Crist, the Caucasian Independent. Is race going to play out in this race with a, you know, little...
race in the race. Well, I mean, I don't know that there's ever been an election that has involved a non-white male in the U.S. that hasn't in some way involved race and or gender. So it certainly, I think, will have an impact. But, you know, and perhaps someone else can speak to this more specifically, but I have to think that Florida is a very complicated state when it comes to race, because it's not just, you know, it's not Black versus white. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a Hispanic aspect, there's the Cuban. I mean, it's very, you have to parse it very finely, I think. And the result could, in fact, be that in some ways it negates the impact of race.
So we're going to move on to Virginia, where Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli issued a legal opinion requiring first trimester abortion clinics to meet hospital standards. Mary Kate, I think you have written something saying that you don't understand why there's drama about this, because...
Yeah, my take on it was that the reaction from the pro-choice crowd... I should back up. The Attorney General wrote a legal opinion that got released yesterday that was authorizing the state health board to write regulations on abortion clinics in Virginia.
That would cause them to have to be up to hospital standards, which
right.
many of them currently are not.
Right. Hospital standards meaning doctors who have privileges at hospitals, mm-hmm. Counselors who are professionally trained, and I think some sort of building code type stuff.
Right.
And that's the part I'm not so sure of what that means. If these opponents had come forward and said, this is onerous, this is expensive, this is unfair, something like that, I would have been like, well, okay, I understand that. The problem was they came forward and they said, this is extremism, this is reckless, he's an ideologue, all this sort of stuff. And my attitude was, well, all he's saying is if you're going to get an abortion in your first trimester, it should be safe, which is what I thought we all have been saying for years, safe and legal.
What about the argument that many are making that it's going to cause clinics to close and make it more difficult for women to get abortions? And Ana, go ahead. You're just like, ah. she's almost pounding her hands on the table here.
I would say that I haven't maybe read as deeply as you have, because what I have been seeing is not people – there are people out there probably saying it's onerous and he's extremist and whatever, but right. or that he's extremist and this is right. you know, unjust. But I just see it personally, looking at the history of abortion in America, as onerous. And as an attempt to, it's something called the TRAP strategy, which is the targeted targeted regulation of abortion providers, which is sort of the strategy that abortion opponents have latched onto in the past 10 years or so, which is not criminalization, but to simply make abortion more and more expensive and harder to get.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. We're in the beauty shop, you know, the counterbalance to the barbershop. We're speaking with Mary-Kate Carey of U.S. News and World Report, Robin Gavan of The Washington Post, Anna Marie Cox of GQ Magazine, and Galina Espinoza of Latina Magazine. And Galina, what do you think about this abortion issue?
I completely agree with Anna on this. I think that this is, yet another attempt for them to get around federal law. I mean, by their own admission, they don't have the right to tinker with that, and yet this is another way of attacking it, of getting around it. And I think that that's something that, again, that we're seeing. This is a strategy being employed across the country. We see it in Arizona, you know, with their attempts to regulate immigration policy, which is again under the behest of the federal government, and yet they're finding loopholes that they can attack. And I think that that's exactly what we're seeing in this case.
I hate to move from abortion to something so, well, you know, tabloidy, but Tiger Woods' divorce is
all final. Right. I'm okay with moving away from it. I mean.
And his ex-wife has now spoken with People magazine, and she says, "I felt stupid as more things were revealed. How could I not have known anything?" Elin's home country of Sweden is offering her congratulations. Robin, do you?
Well, you know, congratulations. I think it would be in order if this is, you know, not to be cliche, but if this is sort of the best way for her to move forward, then good for her. But I mean, I do think that it's, you know, it's interesting that there's this kind of subtext of how could she not know? And to me, when you raise that question, it's almost like you're assigning just a little bit of blame. So how could you not?
You mean to her?
To her. How could you not be attentive enough to know? How could you not be perceptive enough to know? How could you not be involved enough in the relationship to know? And I think that's what sort of bothers me when people sort of raise that question, because I think it's completely possible to be very involved in your relationship and very committed to it and still not know, because people lie.
Come on, Galina.
Yes, I have to say that I'm also amazed, because I've heard that a lot from women and from readers and from people posting online, where people fundamentally have a hard time accepting that she didn't know that he was being unfaithful. In fact, I've heard conspiracy theories that she knew all along and that she had accepted it, and that
it
was part of some sort of negotiation in her marriage, and that she was staying in it for the money and for the exposure. And the incredible backlash that she has faced, I have found very telling about our culture.
Anna Marie, what do you think about that? Is there a backlash against her for this?
I think maybe there is. I have to say one just cliche thing, which is that divorce is always more fun as a spectator sport. Because I'm a child divorce and I'm married, and there's a part of me that when it gets covered in the tabloid and we talk about it being a fun topic away from abortion, it's terrible. And I think that's the part where I almost cringe at offering her congratulations, because if she's a human person, if she's human at all, I don't think she probably feels good about this.
The thing that struck this for me, I guess, was watching all the fun that was being made of her, the whole Saturday Night Live skits and everything. And I'm not married, you know, but I'm thinking, if I am this woman that's going through this, do you really want people just mocking you on national television for what's got to be the dissolution, whether or not you were in it to win it, shall we say, or in it for real? That's got to hurt you. I mean, don't you think, Mary-Kate?
Yeah. I mean, I read the People magazine piece. It got some advanced copy got out this morning, and so I was reading it. And she sat for those interviews for 19 hours. And the People magazine guy who's reporting it really kind of jumps in with his own opinion and says she was so gracious, so shocked by all this, but yet not bitter. And he thought she was just a model for other women who have been through this. And we've seen a bunch of high-profile divorces lately where the women were not exactly models. And I think, you know, she's young, and I don't want to say congratulations either, because I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but I think she's...
Well, except for the alleged $750 million part.
Well, right.
There's that.
But I don't get the sense she was in it for that. Maybe I'm misreading it, but this conspiracy stuff is just kind of sad. Like, nobody would wish that on anybody.
I feel like anyone's ever been in a relationship, it's not just having been being married, but like having been in relationships, you know, you always want to believe the best about your partner.
Right.
Like it's so believable to me that she didn't know. I feel like, you know.
And especially the whole golf lifestyle.
Oh,
these guys are never home.
She was busy raising the kids.
Even the guys who live in town and play golf are never home, you know?
So Galina, should she have left? And fairly briefly, should she have just packed up and gotten out?
Oh, I think it's too hard to ever speak for someone else because you really don't know what goes on behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And I do know that she herself was a child of divorce and always felt very strongly that she never wanted that for her kids. And I certainly believe in reading this interview that it was for the kids that she stayed and tried to work it out and was hopeful that it was going to work it out. It was a real marriage for her. And she thought she could put her family back together. But obviously, this was one situation that could not be repaired.
Robin, briefly, do you think she should have just bailed? And I mean briefly.
Yes, I do. Based on the evidence that I have, I think she should have bailed. I don't think it was reparable.
Okay. Mary Kate Carey is a former presidential speechwriter, columnist, and blogger at U.S. News and World Report. Robin Givhan is the Pulitzer Prize-winning fashion editor for The Washington Post. And Anna Marie Cox is Washington correspondent for GQ magazine. They were here in our studios in Washington. And Galena Espinoza is editorial director at Latina magazine. She joined us from New York. Thank you, ladies, for a scintillating conversation, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Allison Keyes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.